from WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. It's been more than 30 years since there's been so much turnover in a president's cabinet going into a second term. With eight secretaries stepping down and two more rumored out the door, President Bush is briskly reshaping the chorus of voices surrounding him. Tonight on Point, the Bush cabinet house cleaning, what it says about power in Washington and the shape of the president's second term. But first, we begin tonight in Washington, where congressional leaders reached a deal today on the stalled bill intended to overhaul the country's intelligence system. The intelligence bill would enact major recommendations of the September 11th commission, including the appointment of a national intelligence czar to oversee the CIA and other spy agencies. Gail Shattuck covers Congress for the Christian Science Monitor and joins me now. Gail, thanks for being with us. What is the horse trading, Gail, that made this deal possible?
That is the $30,000 question at this point, Tom. On the surface, it was a change in language that looks very minor. There was a provision in the president's initial proposal to Congress, Section 6, that called for preservation of authority and accountability, which means that the lines of authority from the president right down to the field commander would not be disrupted. Now, those that are supporting the 9/11 proposal say that they have included this all along and that the deal announced today with much fanfare really constitutes no real change.
And yet, just last week, this bill was considered dead for this term, and they'd have to take it up again next spring, and now here it is with legs again.
Exactly. What's going to happen is there will be regulations written and some minor changes in the law that we haven't seen yet. But it's an immense tactical move on the part of the president and the vice president who negotiated this deal. It saves face for Chairman Hunter, chairman of the House Armed Services Committee, who was standing in the way of this bill. It also gives the Congress a sense that they're not just a rubber stamp, that they saw a concern that the bill might be interfering with the right of field commanders to call in spy satellites when they needed them or other problems. But at the same time, it allows the bill to go forward. So it's certainly an immense political move. It's not very clear how much it actually changes the substance of the bill.
And now the White House is saying they expect passage this week when it
That's
was stalled
right.
so recently, maybe even as early as tomorrow, with the National Intelligence Director being established. But what about, there was a lot of talk in the last few days about the time-tested chain of command. Is it clear, will this new director really have authority over American intelligence, which was the fundamental point of the intelligence reform, or will he still be a bystander to the Pentagon's use of that system?
Well, the budget piece is still intact. I think the issue that...
intact meaning...
That is that the new intelligence director will have budget authority.
Mm-hmm.
There were some adjustments made, but they don't seem to be critical to the substance of the bill. The real question has to do with who actually controls intelligence. And like many of these things, Tom, this is going to be worked out in practice with people more than just what's written in the rules. The rule change is not that significant. Proponents say it's not different than what they originally agreed to.
But something has changed here.
If you have a national intelligence director that is willing to take a back seat to the Pentagon, nothing will have changed. If you have someone who takes a very aggressive stance on the job, especially on the allocation of intelligence assets, you're going to see some clashes on this point.
So last week the word was that whatever he said, Donald Rumsfeld didn't want this to happen. Senator Warner and others were warning about this. Is there a sense that the Pentagon caved here, that they gave in on this, or that they've received assurances that whatever the format is, they're going to continue to have the oversight that they want?
What I'm hearing is that the Pentagon is going to continue to have the oversight that they want, especially in any situation involving a war.
Mm-hmm.
That is, when there are troops in the field and bullets flying. There will be no interference with that flow of authority and intelligence that they feel they need.
Well, presumably there'll be more detail coming out about this in the next few days, but President Bush has, with a lot of urging, stood up and apparently won a green light for this legislation that he's publicly put himself behind. Gail Shattuck, thanks very much for joining us tonight.
You're welcome.
Gail Shattuck covers Congress for the Christian Science Monitor. She spoke with me from Washington. With his landslide re-election over George McGovern in 1972, Richard Nixon asked for and got resignation letters from his entire cabinet. Many of those letters he accepted. Not since then has a second-term president cleaned house like George Bush is cleaning house right now. Eight cabinet members out. Two more, Snow and Mineta at Treasury and Transportation, rumored to be going. That is a turnover for the record books. And the profile of the new crew, including a CEO from Kellogg's and a former New York City top cop, says something about the direction Bush sees for his second term. But the new cabinet is historic for other reasons as well. It has an unprecedented number of ethnic minorities, and its ranks are filled with men and women who rose to power from disadvantaged backgrounds. And they are overwhelmingly personally close and personally loyal to the president. Tonight on Point, the Bush cabinet changeover and what it says about power in Washington and the president's second term. You can join the conversation. What do you make of this new crew? Is it better to have loyalists all on the same song sheet? Are there independent thinkers here, or a cabinet that will salute and hup to? And which is better for the country? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Washington is Richard Benedetto, Washington correspondent for USA Today. He's been covering the changes in the Bush cabinet. Richard Benedetto, thanks a lot for being with us tonight.
Good to be with you.
So let us know where this stands. Now, we've got eight out as of right now. There are a lot of rumors flying about Treasury Secretary John Snow and Transportation Secretary Norman Mineta. What about their fates as we speak
this evening? I think Mineta has made it clear that he wanted to leave after the first 4 years.
Mm-hmm.
And in the case of Snow, I think that there is a the White House would like to make a change there, even though they've been very positive about remarks about Snow.
So he may be going soon as well.
Yes.
And overall, when you look at the changes that have happened here, Richard, what's the pattern? How do you describe the pattern of the change or the turnover?
I think that the way Washington has been the Washington media have been trying to describe the pattern is that Bush is stacking his cabinet with loyalists. Well, first of all, that's a pretty strange thing to even talk about, because the fact is that you would assume that the people who the president puts in these top jobs would be loyal to him.
Mm-hmm.
You expect that. You wouldn't expect to point people who wouldn't be loyal to him.
Well, and yet in his first term, he put Colin Powell in, who had kind of his own base of public support and perhaps his own view of the world.
He did, but he still was loyal to the president. There was no case in which he wasn't loyal to the president. He carried out the president's policies, even if he disagreed with them.
Mm-hmm.
But he carried them out. That's what you do if you have those positions. You either carry out the policy of the commander in chief or the chief executive, or you leave if you don't agree. In the case of Colin Powell, he carried out the policies that Bush wanted. Even though he raised, cabinet members should are expected to express their own opinions, and Bush even says he wants to hear them all give their views and varying views. But in the end, he makes the final decision. And he expects after he makes that decision, everybody goes out and carries it out.
There was a sense in the first term that President Bush oversaw a number of Donnybrooks, real knockdown, drag-out debates. With this new cabinet coming online, is that kind of tension likely to be less? Leave aside the loyalty issue for a moment. Are these men and women of the kind of independent background that are likely to strongly challenge fundamental strategies that the White House was guided by in its first term to strongly challenge one another?
I think that it'll probably might be less so in the case of, say, maybe at State, where you've got Condoleezza Rice going in to take the place of Powell. Condoleezza Rice is pretty much on the same page with the president. We don't know, because we aren't that privy to information, how much disagreement she had inside the White House with the president, but the president does have a great deal of trust in her opinion. What the problem at the State Department was, as far as the Bush, the president himself was concerned, he didn't like the idea that that a lot of the people in the lower levels of the State Department were speaking off the record to reporters and complaining and about the Bush policy and telling reporters that what they didn't like about it. He was concerned that Powell didn't have a good handle on that.
As a reporter, are you thinking, Richard Benedetto, that in the second term, with this tighter circle of Bush confidants and loyalists, that there may be less leaking, less sniping?
No, I think that there might be, and the reason why it will be is not because Condoleezza Rice has clamped down on it. The reason why there'll be less leaking and less sniping is because there won't be an election that they're trying to overturn.
Mm-hmm.
I think that what was going on, and a good part of what was going on in the State Department in the latter part of the past year or so, was a lot of people who were John Kerry supporters who were talking to the press or who were covering foreign affairs and giving their own opinion, and basically it was against the administration. So I think that there was a motive involved, and I think that with that pressure off, there will be less of that. Not that it'll stop. It certainly is not going to stop, but it will. I think there will be less of it.
There's talk of President Bush's longtime chief of staff, Andrew Card, coming in as Treasury Secretary. That could play out as a very important position in this second term, given the focus on Social Security and tax reform. What have you heard on that front?
Well, that's one of the names that has been mentioned, Andrew Card. Andrew Card is very well respected by the president. He came in and did a chief of staff job. Is one of the staff jobs that doesn't get an awful lot of publicity, but nonetheless, it's a very important job in the White House. He's the person, or she, if there's a woman, is the person who has to keep all the ships afloat, and that's not an easy task, and keep everybody happy at the same time. Andrew Card has handled that job, as far as the president is concerned, superbly, and because there hasn't been an awful lot of mess ups. And one of the things we never hear. One of the words we never hear used to describe the Bush White House is chaotic. We never hear that one. And we have heard that in other White Houses. And this is one that has. And I think in large part, it's the management style of Bush, and it's the job that Andrew Card has done there. Now, if he wants to move him over to Treasury, it'll be because the president has a specific job that he thinks he needs him to do.
Richard Benedetto, stand by. I want to welcome into our conversation, joining us tonight from Hanover, New Hampshire, Jack Beatty, On Point News Analyst and Senior Editor at the Atlantic Monthly. Hello, Jack. Good to have you tonight.
Hello, Tom.
So we've just been hearing from Richard about the changeover that we're in the midst of now, a very big one, as big as Richard Nixon's in 72, and perhaps soon bigger. What's your sense of the direction, the thrust that this cabinet change means, Jack, or brings?
Well, to me, it's already historic, not in the number, but in where the people have been appointed from. If Card is appointed to Treasury, that would be four people from the White House staff: Rice to State, Margaret Spellings to Education, mm-hmm. Al Gonzalez to the Attorney General, and Card to Treasury. That would be four people from the White House staff in cabinet positions. Now, the White House staff, that's all politics all the time. Their whole job, including Rice's, is to make the president look good. And there's nothing. The only thing I can find to close to it is under Reagan in his second term. He appointed Ed Meese from his staff, Attorney General, and Jim Baker to Treasury. But if Card goes, that'll be twice the Reagan ratio. Clinton appointed one member of his staff. That was Robert Rubin, a highly qualified analyst to the Treasury. So this is appointing staff people from the White House, and these are political appointments in every sense of the word. And you know, you ask yourself, well, what didn't Bush like about the first cabinet? Another way to answer that is to say, what got people fired? Well, the short answer is telling the truth. Lawrence Lindsay was fired for giving what we now know to be a modest estimate of what the cost of the Iraq War was. Paul O'Neill was fired because he didn't get on. He didn't think that the dividend tax cut was affordable, and he expressed that. He went out the window. Christy Todd Whitman was essentially fired because, again, she was telling inconvenient truths about the environment. And, you know, what isn't going to happen with this crew? Well, you won't have anything like what happened with Colin Powell, where just several months before the Iraq War, the State Department issued a report, no dominoes falling in the Middle East. That is, there'll be no effect of democracy one democracy after another, for all the reasons that we can imagine. Or you won't have anything like Paul O'Neill's report, that there was a $44 trillion gap for the next 75 years in funding. That was a real embarrassment to the president. That won't happen with this crew.
A tighter circle and maybe fewer discordant notes coming out of what was already a pretty tightly run ship. Richard Benedetto with USA Today, thank you so much for being with us tonight. We're talking tonight about the Bush cabinet exodus, house cleaning, and what it says about power in Washington. You can join us. 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Asbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the Bush cabinet house cleaning and what it says about power in Washington, about the president's second term. You can join our question tonight. What do you think? What's the ratio of personal loyalty to policy expertise in this emerging new cabinet? Did you assume that Donald Rumsfeld would be among the last secretaries standing for Bush from Bush term one? Is Condoleezza Rice an upgrade from Colin Powell at State or a step down? And I guess overall, what's better for the country, a cabinet of strong-minded individuals of stature or a loyal team that's completely on board with little independent power base? What works best in your mind? 1-800-423-8255 is our number. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're joined tonight by our news analyst, Jack Beatty, and right now from Washington by Ken Rudin, National Public Radio's political editor. Ken Rudin, wonderful to have you. Thanks so much for joining us tonight.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
We've been hearing from Richard Benedetto at USA Today. I'd love to hear your overall characterization of how this second-term team is going to compare in proximity to the president's point of view, in background to the first-term cabinet.
Well, you know, you always feel that a first term, basically at the end of a first term, the administration and administration runs out of steam, and often you get your second best choices in a second administration. But having said that, I kind of got a sense that Bush's election in 2000, of course, had all those, you know, Barry Bonds asterisks next to it.
Meaning?
You know? He lost the popular vote,
right,
all that
right.
stuff. So maybe he went to Ashcroft because he had to appease the right. He went to a Colin Powell because he has an international stature. And so I know there's a lot of criticism that basically the second Bush cabinet is a bunch of yes men and yes women, but in the sense that I think Bush feels more comfortable with himself and obviously the cabinet as well.
How would you describe the top items on the Bush agenda for this term that will surely has informed who he's brought in and the kind of team that he's presented? What's the agenda that he's most concerned about now, Ken?
Well, certainly, you know, if you go on the economic front, certainly about tax cuts and certainly changing Social Security. And, you know, I think we're mistaken if we make the assumption that it's John Snow, the Treasury Secretary, who's really making economic policy, just like we could say it's a mistake to say that Spencer Abraham was making energy policy as Secretary of Energy. It really comes out of the White House. It comes certainly with energy. It comes out of Vice President Cheney's office. It's the administration. Basically, one reason if John Snow goes, I missed what your conversation earlier, but if John Snow does go, it's not because his policies are wrong or differs from the president. The administration needs a better salesman to make these cases, even though they have a friendlier Congress. There's more ambitious agenda for the second term, and that's why they may need somebody else instead.
I want to stick with that for a minute, Ken Rudin, about where the real policy engine lies in this administration. Because, I mean, if you put Andy Card at Treasury, this is a very experienced man, but not a man with that kind of financial background to speak of. So who's the real policy engine? If it's coming from the White House, what does that mean? Karl Rove, we know, is the great political strategist, but when you come to all these other areas, who's the real mind that's driving the fundamental policy that's being laid?
Well, that's a very good question. I mean, one of the interesting things, I didn't even realize that Andy Card was interested in Treasury until it was mentioned in the paper the other day, because I always thought that, you know, given the fact that he was the guy who whispered in Bush's ear at 9/11, he's the one who's been with the president on almost every decision, even before the Florida Supreme Court finished counting those votes. Card, I think, you know, is part of the inner circle with Card and, of course, Cheney and, to a lesser extent, Rumsfeld, but, you know, and the Wolfowitz is in the foreign policy. And I would be very surprised for that reason if Card left that circle of powerful advisors.
So he won't leave it, but yet someone is making policy, very large policy. We're talking about trying to fundamentally reform Social Security, about fundamental tax reform. Jack Beatty, what's your sense? I mean, the kind of traditional textbook view of the cabinet is that you bring in people, traditionally men and white, that no longer the case with this cabinet, but that you bring in experienced people with great depth in a particular area of expertise who will offer policy alternatives to the president. It doesn't seem to be working that way with this new setup.
No, it doesn't at all. And if you look through this, I mean, you can see motives, but they don't go to policy, it seems to me. Rice is clearly going to purge the State Department, I should think. I mean, that's going to be and some of the people that were disloyal under Powell will go or will quit. And, you know, you look at Gonzalez, well, he's being groomed for a Supreme Court appointment, some people say. And
out of the Attorney General's chair. Yeah.
Right. And let's also face it that, you know, he's going to be sitting on the Valerie Plame investigation, which, you know, allegations go back to the office of to Scooter Libby, the aide to Vice President Cheney, and mentions of Karl Rove as a possible suspect in leaking her name. So he's going to be sitting over that, and will he be zealous in prosecuting that? I doubt it. I don't know. Maybe it won't be in his hands. And you know, so I don't know that. Now Spellings is at least has experience in education. That's
yes.
been her field. She was with Bush in
Texas.
In Texas. Mm-hmm. And there's some talk there that she wants to extend No Child Left Behind to high school. Now it goes up to what, the eighth grade,
yeah,
and there's some talk to have of sort of extending that model into high school. Now that's going to take expertise, and I can see that working well for her there. But just in terms of the domestic agenda, it seems less that than a matter of I want people who are going to be loyal, not only loyal, but whose whole ambition is going to be to make me look good, rather than I need heavyweights to represent this policy.
But you know the alternative, of course, is Andrew Young. You know, when he was UN ambassador under Jimmy Carter, he met with the PLO. Now, of course, that's not something Jimmy Carter wanted to leak out. One, he was fighting for renomination.
Yep.
Two, he knew that the Jewish vote was very important in the Democratic primaries. And, you know, also one of Janet Reno, who was completely independent of Clinton and basically started her own investigations, much to the chagrin of the Clinton administration. I mean, we like to talk about democracy, but the cabinet meeting is certainly in public, is not a democratic body. It's not the Senate where, you know, you could have 100 guys yammering at one time. It's really, you know, to make, obviously the president doesn't need to win re-election, but he still has to have his successful second term. He has a lot of tasks ahead of him, both in economic foreign policy and Supreme Court nominations, and obviously he doesn't want to be embarrassed.
And the argument gets made. He's got a policy. He put it before the country. They voted. He won. So why not bring on a crew that's going to closely support that? I want to begin to bring our callers in. Let's hear from them. We're at 1-800-423-8255. Dave is calling from Jamesville, Wisconsin. Hi, Dave. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to make a couple of points. The first one is President Bush came into office and he was, many said that we're entering a new era where we now have the MBA president, you know, someone who has a somewhat atypical background for a president.
The B-school executive on top. Yep.
Yeah, but he doesn't appear to be managing in that fashion. It seems that qualifications or expertise is a distinctly secondary requirement for these individuals that he's putting in many of the jobs. And like one of your earlier callers said, I don't believe loyalty is the right word, but it seems that he's surrounding himself with people who are not who are not going to buck the predetermined party line.
David, if the president thinks he's got his strategy figured out and he's just been endorsed with an electoral win, why should he do otherwise?
Well, I think that it's fine to have very big, broad strategies, but as you know from a business analogy, actual implementation of strategies is work. It's more than just putting a couple bullets on a PowerPoint slide. And in the business model, a good senior manager surrounds themselves with technical people. When you have major issues, you have good and open and honest discussion. And then once a decision is reached, then everybody salutes smartly and we charge off and execute.
Dave, we've got it. We thank very much for your call from Jamesville. I want to welcome into our conversation to respond right there from Cambridge, Massachusetts, David Gergen. He's director of the Center for Public Leadership at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. He served as a White House advisor to four presidents, Nixon, Ford, Reagan, and Bill Clinton. He's author of Eyewitness to Power, The Essence of Leadership, Nixon to Clinton. David Gergen, thanks so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
I wonder if you can share your thoughts with us here, David Gergen, on a kind of bumptious cabinet of strong-willed, strong-background, independent thinkers versus the characterization that's being given to this new Bush cabinet, loyalists with personal obligations and almost debts to this president who aren't going to rock the boat. What works better? Is there a rule of thumb?
Well, almost every president I've known in the last 30 years has run a campaign pledged to cabinet government. And the whole idea of delegating power to really strong people out in the cabinet offices and letting them take charge of their areas and bringing former governors and the like. And within a very short time, one finds that power returns ineluctably to the White House, where the White House staff really begins to control things. And I think what we now see is a very much on display the fact that this next term of the Bush administration is going to be run out of the White House and run with a very small number of people who will be calling the shots, and no longer are there any pretenses that they're going to be governors out in the cabinet departments setting policy. I mean, they look for a Treasury secretary, and they're talking about getting a salesman.
Not Andy Card.
Policy market. Well, that's right. And even when they went to get Jon Snow in the middle of the first term, they weren't talking about getting a major architect of economic policy. They talked about getting a salesman. That only says one thing, that the policy controls remain in the White House.
So let me put the same question to you, David Gergen, that I put to our other guests earlier. Then in that case, where is the true policy engine of this administration? If it's not big independent cabinet figures thinking these things through, how do you trace the line back? Where does fundamental policy originate from?
I think fundamental policy originates from a small handful of people, a coterie of people, that the president and his closest, most powerful advisors. And clearly, in this case, it's his vice president, which is an unprecedented amount of power and authority rests with the vice president. And he's the single most important advisor to the president. The president has made no secret of that. I've been in sessions with him, and others have been in sessions with him, and he said, "Dick Cheney is my most important advisor." Clearly, policy also comes from Karl Rove. I think these are the two most important players around the president. Others who contribute have certainly been Condi Rice, and she'll be a powerful player at the State Department, but Andy Card, the Chief of Staff, and Karen Hughes, who has departed but nonetheless remains an important voice.
So there it is, and now uninflected or unchanged by the men and women who will be out in the secretaryships executing on this policy.
Well, I think that's right. And there is, I must tell you that the president is entitled to do this. It goes with the territory, and we've seen this happen before, but George W. Bush is not the first person to run policy out of the White House. Richard Nixon was famous for that, and as he moved into his second term, he indeed he elevated four of his cabinet officers to be sort of the super cabinet.
Yep.
And brought them into the old executive office building right next door, so that they were they were extensions of the president himself. So he's certainly within his rights.
And you don't see this as a more tightly wound, tightly controlled cabinet or policymaking engine than in these other presidencies you're referencing, David Gergen?
I think it's more tightly wound than almost anyone we've seen since Nixon. I think he's certainly within his rights. Whether he's wise or not, whether he's right or not, is a separate question. And I have to tell you, I think the president would be better off, I think, if he had more people who were voices of dissent or innovative voices or voices of speaking out of the box. Because it struck me that while on some decisions he made you could have to say he made shrewd decisions in his first term. There were examples when I think that a fellow who wrote the book called Groupthink, a fellow named Janus who wrote that book, which was really about Vietnam, was a famous book in sociology. I think that and psychology too, that you'd have a revised version of Groupthink coming out about the Iraq War. And I think the president needs, in this instance, particularly this president who operates to a significant degree on his hunches and his predispositions, I think he would benefit from more dissident voices around him. I just think he'd be a lot brighter. Be a lot wiser. I think the other dynamic here that one can't dismiss is that the grassroots conservative movement is a formidable force within American politics now, which is going to continually put pressure on a change in the agenda. What the president ran on is a static agenda, but it's not going to remain static very long. Already, for example, it's the grassroots conservative movement is pushing very hard for Kofi Annan to be forced out of the UN.
David Gergen, hold that thought. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Let's grab another call here. Dave is calling from San Francisco. Hi, Dave. You're on the air.
Yes, greetings from this side of the world. I was pretty shocked when I heard the constant theme that the president demands and will receive obedience from his cabinet. Frankly, you know, as a person who believes in democracy, I think that there's a shocking lack of respect for the Constitution with a thing like that. But there's a second aspect, and it's really what I would call a bait and switch. 4 years ago, excuse me, when he was first elected, it was recognized that he was not the brightest guy in the world, but he was going to surround himself with bright people and intelligent people, and we were going to have good, capable hands in the management of our property, the government. And it was even recognized that Dick Cheney was really going to be in charge, even though that was a kind of a whispered acknowledgement.
I'm not sure a lot of President Bush's supporters would describe it that way, but I know the point of view you're describing, Dave.
Right. Well, this was clearly in the discussion of the day leading up to the 2000 election. So now, all of a sudden, we're going to get pure obedience to a man who clearly doesn't and has not been recognized as an intelligent figure. So we're just going to get pure obedience, and that the cabinet is supposed to simply obey a man who is not known to be intelligent.
Well, and yet he's still got a circle around him, and he was, I'd have to say, call him what you will, he just won a re-election. There's some kind of...
that he won. I think that the Ohio vote count and the Florida vote count and the New Mexico vote count and perhaps even a great deal of problems in Oklahoma, a notorious red state. There are some...
Might help. Dave, we got the fundamental point, though, and thanks for calling in with it. David Gergen, what about this point? Do you see a diminution in the quality of advice the president's likely to get in this second term or not?
Well, I don't agree with the point that that this is anti-democratic. There's only one person in this administration, or two really, who got elected, and that's the president and Dick Cheney. And
that's what's required.
Yeah, that's what's required. No member of the cabinet got elected. Mm-hmm. They're selected, and they work for the president. And we don't have a parliamentary system in which mm-hmm. members of parliament serve in a government. It's quite a different system, and I think this is the one that the Americans have agreed to. Whether it's the right one or not, it's a different question. As to whether the president is a dim bulb or a bright bulb, I think that you made the right point. He did win the election. I think all of this, you know, this carping about the votes in Ohio. I don't know any serious observer who believes that even if every vote were recounted, the outcome would be any different from Ohio. The margin was such there that, you know, after all, Pennsylvania is a closer one than that, and Kerry won Pennsylvania. You could recount Pennsylvania. You could recount everything. I think Bush would still be the winner.
Well, David Gergen, stand by. Sure. Ken Rudin, Jack Beatty. We'll come back and look at the quality of advice the president's likely to get and where he's headed with this team in the second term. You can join the conversation tonight. How do you respond to the ethnic diversity of this cabinet, to the up-by-the-bootstraps stories of this crew? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the Bush cabinet house cleaning and what it says about how power is exercised in George Bush's Washington, what it says about the focus of the president's second term. We're joined tonight by David Gergen, advisor to four presidents, Nixon, Ford, Reagan, and Clinton, author of Eyewitness to Power, The Essence of Leadership, Nixon to Clinton, by Ken Rudin, National Public Radio's political editor in Washington, and our own Jack Beatty. You can join the conversation tonight. How do you respond to the ethnic diversity of this cabinet, to the up-by-the-bootstraps stories of this crew? In what direction do you expect this group to take the country? And who or what is missing from this cabinet? Rudy Giuliani, John McCain? What is George Bush buckling in for with this team? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Steve is calling from Bourne, Massachusetts. Hi, Steve. You're on the air.
Yeah, hi. Here's the point I wanted to make, and I think it's especially terrific that David Gergen is on the line perhaps to answer it, and that is most of the commentary has suggested that Bush has made these choices, basically backfilling these cabinet positions from within the White House by design.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, I would rather suggest that he may have been doing this by necessity, since he has been unable to attract many of the heavyweight establishment Republicans who could step into these jobs and who I think he would be proud to have step into these jobs. There is a degree of alienation among establishment Republicans toward this president that I think is another of the great hamstrings he's going to have to endure in the second term.
That is an interesting observation, Steve. Thanks for calling in with it. David Gergen, what do you think of it?
Perhaps that's true, but that's not my sense of it. I'm not sure what that means by establishment Republicans. There are lots of
maybe Brent Scowcroft and.
He's moved beyond that generation.
Yes.
I would love to see Brent Scowcroft in government. I think he would be a voice of real reason and as a man of stature, be respected overseas. But the truth is, I think he does have a number of choices. He just brought in a Nebraska governor. I think there are a lot of other folks he could get. I do think he wants it this way. I think my sense of it is that this is a fellow who thought coming in the first time that he didn't really know Washington very well and he did need to be surrounded by heavyweights. And he's now sort of feels, okay, I got this. I understand how to make this thing work. Now I want people who are going to do what I need to get done. And that's a very different approach. He's entitled, but if I were asked my counsel, I would say, Mr. President, I think he'd be better served by having some real heavyweights. For example, I think the country with the dollar as fragile as it is right now,
yes,
we need a real heavyweight in there on the economic side. We need an economic policy team, not the White House driving economic policy. You simply don't have the resources in the White House, if I may say so, Tom, to really develop a sophisticated policy. You've just got a small group of people in there.
I'm wondering about. Here, there's so much to be worked out, and if it all comes back to a little crew in the White House, that's a small head of the pin to dance on.
Yeah, exactly. And you need for some really complex. The tax system is one of the most complex parts of our whole government. It's hugely complex, and you've got to have some top-flight people at the Treasury down into not just at the secretary level, but the deputy and the assistant secretaries, secretaries, and then using the civil service to really work this stuff through. Social Security is going to be a horribly complex question before it's over. Mm. You can't just do that on the back of an envelope out of the White House, and you just have a corporal's guard in there in any one of these problems to deal with, just as you can't. You can't run foreign policy out of the NSC staff. You've got to rely on people over at the State Department.
David Gergen, let me turn to Ken Rudin in Washington for a moment. Ken, what's your sense of how Washington, the kind of inside the Beltway, inner circle, is responding to this cabinet on exactly this point of whether or not it's got the depth, it's got the horsepower to deliver on all the policy fronts that a second-term presidency is likely to address?
Well, I mean, if you look at the first administration, the first Bush administration, people said there was a depth. You had the Colin Powell, but of course he disagreed. He clearly disagreed.
Right, so stymied.
Going to war against Iraq. You had John Ashcroft, who basically had his own agenda, and perhaps he was a sop to the conservatives when Bush didn't have the bona fides with the right. So, I mean, and again, we always say that a second term are the people who didn't make the cut in the first term. But, look, did Bill Rogers, is he the foreign policy guy in the Nixon administration? No, of course, it was Kissinger and NSC. I'm just thinking that, David Gergen was talking about, David Gergen has been around a long time and he's seen all these guys. Cyrus Vance in the Carter White House. I mean, he had a public disagreement with the hostage situation and resigned. Is that better for the president? I mean, obviously there has to be some kind of discussion behind closed doors, but I don't think you want an open forum of disagreements, because then the question will be who's in charge here. We know who's in charge in this administration. In previous administration, you could say, nobody's in charge.
Jack Beatty, we'll get David Gergen's reply there, but let me just hear from you on this, on the idea of the president as kind of thinks he's got it figured out, as David Gergen says. He's got reelection. Why should he have a battling crew of heavyweights with big independent egos and power bases? If he thinks he knows where he wants to go, why not just bring in a crew that heads straight toward that? There are enough cross currents, Lord knows, in Washington.
Two reasons, authority and competence. To have someone of authority look you in the eye and say, this is not the right thing to do, Mr. President. The president has said famously to Bob Woodward, the great thing about being president is you don't have to explain yourself. He doesn't explain himself to any of these folks he's appointed. They know his every thought. And that's not what he needs. That's not what the country needs. When Harry Truman was going to recognize the state of Israel, George Marshall looked him in the eye and said, Mr. President, if you do this, I may not vote for you at the next election. Well, Truman was nonplussed. He didn't know what to make of that. And it threw him because of the immense moral and policy authority of George C. Marshall. That's what you need. You need people. And then competence. Look at the person he's retained, the author of this incredible disaster in Iraq, Mr. Rumsfeld. Competence. And then Ms. Rice. I mean, look. People going back a year and more have said that she was an incompetent in that job. And so that's not the issue. The country needs authority, people of weight who can look him in the eye and say, no, this is wrong. And it needs competence, people who can do a job and who just can't, you know, keep churning out the mistakes.
But you had authority and you had competence with Colin Powell. And what good did it do him?
When it's at cross purposes to the dominant agenda, David Gergen, What do you make of this? And I know you to be a very insightful guy, but a very diplomatic guy. But how do you assess, looking at this new cabinet that's emerging, the, let's use Jack Beatty's terms, the authority and competence, if you look right across the board here?
I think Jack Beatty's thrust is right, essentially right. And I think it is valuable to have people with the weight of a George Marshall in the cabinet. My disagreement about, listen, the Powell thing would have turned out very differently if they'd actually had people sitting around a round table and really worked it through before they went into Iraq. They never had that meeting. They never had any series of meetings.
It was a done deal.
It was a done deal. You need people to really sit down and work their way through these big, thorny, difficult questions that face the country. And frankly, you need someone like a George Ball in there who can be a voice of dissent, or an Adlai Stevenson. You know, Ball and Stevenson were both, particularly Ball was proven right, but Adlai Stevenson was not on the Bay of Pigs. But it helped for Kennedy to have those kind of voices. When Kennedy faced the Bay of Pigs, he didn't just bring in Stevenson, he also brought in Dean Acheson. It was the hawk who came into this thing. Now, that frankly helped his deliberations. You know, the classic model of decision making for president was Kennedy during the 13 days during the October missile crisis. And what you see there are real heavyweights, you know, battling it out in front of the president and often in their own private sessions, and it works. I will tell you that Reagan. You know, this point about, you know, shouldn't be surrounded by people who disagree. Reagan had people around him who disagreed, and there were huge fights that went on within the administration, quietly, for the most part, but they often spilled into the papers. And it helped Reagan to have people sort of fight it out in front of him. If there was a Richard Perle in that administration, but there was a Richard Byrd over at the State Department, the assistant secretary level, and they fought like cats and dogs, but it made a healthier administration. These questions that come to the president tend to be sort of 55-45 calls. They're very complex, and somebody has got to be willing to argue for the 45% side.
But it sounds as though George Bush may be done with that. He knows his gut. He knows his hunch. He's got his second-term mandate, and he's ready to go. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Let's turn to Mark in Romance, Wisconsin. Hi, Mark. You're on the air.
Thanks so much for taking my call.
Sure.
You know, as somebody who is not at all a fan of George Bush, from my perspective, I think the greatest flaw of this administration throughout the first 4 years, and it's set up to repeat in the second four years, is that of hubris. And I say at this point, let Bush be Bush. Let Cheney be Cheney. Let the neocons be the neocons. And what I feel is going to
Bring on the deluge, as a critic, I guess.
You know, as they close off from broader, more nuanced and sophisticated views, the reality, while they may not like reality, reality is going to weigh down.
But if it's a comeuppance you're asking for, it's a comeuppance that we're all going to share a part in.
Absolutely, and we put ourselves into this position. Pride will cut this man from power faster than anything else. And the timid ditto heads that are making up the cabinet.
Well, but he's looking at four more years, and he's talking up this group. Mark, thanks for your call. Ken Rudin, I wonder if there's not another perspective here. I think George Bush looks at this and says, I want to do some tough things. I want to cut some Gordian knots here on Social Security, on taxes. We've had, as David Gergen says, we've had some years to figure this out. Why be distracted now by naysayers inside? Let's get a flying wedge and go for it.
Well, that's obviously that's clearly the Bush argument. And while I'm not professing that it's right or wrong, and we've made the case so many times that you do need, as David Gergen said, the 45% are in the cabinet to keep you from making horrific mistakes. But again, you know, if you want to make these changes in Social Security, as the president wants to do, if you want to change the tax code, as you do, you want somebody on your team. I mean, I'm not saying it's better or worse for the country, but it's clearly what the president wants to do for his legacy for the second term.
David Gergen, presidents have had pretty mixed luck in their second terms. Richard Nixon had Watergate, Ronald Reagan, Iran-Contra, Bill Clinton, impeachment, I mean, LBJ, race riots in Vietnam. Second term somehow seemed to invite some pretty deep potholes. Where do you see the dangers for this president in the second term?
Well, you raise a good point. You can't point to a single president in the 20th century whose second term was more productive or more satisfying or better for the country than his first term. Every single one of them, going way all the way back to Woodrow Wilson, had second terms that brought a lot of potholes and a lot of problems.
They didn't all have scandal, but not necessarily big accomplishments. You're saying?
Well, look at Woodrow Wilson. Starting with that, I mean, he had the First World War that he got into, and then he had his defeat over the treaty, and he had a stroke, and you know, trying to sell it, it was just a mess at the end.
Maybe George Bush is trying to avoid that by tightening up the drum so tight here.
Well, he's not. This is a guy who's going for a very ambitious agenda. He's going to go for broke on some big things here now. And I just have to tell you, if it looks on a Social Security, this is a huge deal. And it's not only a question of moving to the 2% out, but there's a huge deficit problem that arises, all sorts of questions, and they're very complex questions. And if we start going down this track too fast, you have no idea what impact it's going to have on the dollar. You have no idea what, you know, confidence overseas is going to look like and what it could do to the economy and to interest rates and the rest. This needs to be done with great, great care. If we're going to go anywhere down this track, and tax reform is very much like that. Now, I have to tell you something. So that's the reason you need a strong cabinet, and you need people in the cabinet departments. It's not just a question of a strong cabinet. You need strong people in government to figure these things out. But here's the other point, Tom, is that there's no single issue you can point to right now that you can say is definitely going to blow up in the face of this president, but you can point to a series of four or five issues that for which there's a percentage chance, say, as someone very wise told me the other day, there's a 15% chance that the dollar is going to go to hell. There's a 15% chance at least that Iran is going to go spiraling off, and we're going to have a serious problem on our hands about nuclear weapons or nuclear programs in Iran we can't seem to control. At least a 15% chance that Iraq's going to go further to hell than it already has, and that this thing is going to go bad for us, or the Shiites are going to come into power.
Civil
and
war,
an alliance
the rest.
With, you can have a civil war. You could have the Shiites forming an alliance with Iran. Mm. Your North Korea. You can think of a series of these
mega tonnage potholes.
And when those happen, they're not scheduled, but you have to be prepared with really good people around you to deal with it, because it's not just the president's political fortune that's at stake here. It's our fortune as Americans. It's the country's fortune that's at stake here on these things. So I think all of us have an interest in having a strong team. I think, as I say, I think he's within his rights. I just don't think it's a wise direction in which he's now taking.
Ken Rudin, there's a bit of a scary prognosis. None of those may happen, but they're pretty big problems if any of them do. Do you see this as a cabinet up to the task?
Well, the bigger question is really with the administration's up to the task. I mean, look, you know, we're talking about all the things that President Bush may or may not do with this so-called 51% mandate.
Yes.
Well, he had no mandate in 2000. Look what he did. It was still, you know, the permanent tax cuts, the war in Iraq. So, you know, you could blame the Secretary of State, Secretary of Defense. Ultimately, it's the President of the United States and his administration that is responsible for this.
Love it or hate it, he was bold then, and he looks placed to be bold again. Ken Rudin, NPR political editor in Washington, thank you so much for being with us tonight.
Thanks a lot.
And David Gergen at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government, author of Eyewitness to Power. Wonderful to have you. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, sir.
And Jack Beatty, great to have you as always. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.